You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Mit Wieso Steuer? Bis zum 31. Juli abgeben.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 53, Marx and the Coup, with Matt Christman. Thanks for joining me. Last episode, we covered the aftermath of the coup of 18 Brumaire. The Directory was gone, replaced by the Consulate. Napoleon had finally risen to power. We closed out with a discussion of the long-term consequences of the coup. Why it was a seminal moment in modern political history, not just in our story. As I said last time, almost everyone since 18 Brumaire has lived in the shadow of the coup. That is especially true for anyone influenced by the writings of the German radical thinker Karl Marx. For Marx, the coup was not only an historical event, but an illustration of much broader political trends. As Marxist thought grew and propagated in the years after Marx's death, his ideas about Brumaire spread with it, transforming the coup from a discrete historical event into an intellectual concept with a life of its own. To help us unpack Marx and the Brumaire coup, I've invited back an old friend, Matt Christman, who you might remember from our bonus episode about Marx and Napoleon III. So, Matt Christman, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
So why don't we just dive right in? What does Bonapartism mean in Marxist jargon?
Bonapartism is it's really a danger. It's something that they were always worried about happening, and in the Soviet Union ended up accusing each other of all the time. And it is that point at which a revolution reaches a point of instability, where it's no longer able to move forward under its own energies in a way that maintains the social order. And to solve that issue, to solve the crisis of legitimacy and stability, one military figure subsumes the entire revolution into themselves. And they saw Napoleon as the model for that. And we're always on the lookout for a Napoleon who is going to emerge in any of their movements.
So that's Bonapartism, Brumaire, when you see that in Marx, that's what they mean. Just kind of that general idea of instability then being resolved with a single leader, not so much Napoleon himself.
Yeah, he's just sort of a stand-in for that. And honestly, I'd say that when you look at the specifics of the French Revolution, especially after Thermidor, I don't know if you can even argue that Napoleon's emergence is necessarily like a tragic betrayal the way that people saw Stalin's or something, because the bourgeois revolution at that point had sort of run its course. And we've talked on before when I was on here talking about Napoleon III, about how the original Napoleon was this syncretic figure who resolved this tension that was existing between the left and the right and created a stable order based on that fusion. And I was thinking about that, and I think the way, and I was actually listening to your episode about the coup itself and the aftermath that really made me think more about this. And in, like, we talked about that broadly, you know, how that was, he was a guy who brought both sides together. But I think specifically what he did is the two principles that he reaffirmed that were central to the project of the reactionary right and the Jacobin left were hierarchy on the right, which they had seen as being the reason that things have been so chaotic, was the lack of a king, right? I mean, they wanted a king back. And Napoleon, by embodying the nation in himself, gave them a figure who could reaffirm a hierarchy along the lines that they sought. But he did it on the terms of meritocracy. And I think meritocracy is really like the guiding principle of the bourgeois revolutionary movement that the left in France represented. They were both because they were both class projects. The right was a class project of the reactionary landholders, and the left was a project of the more progressive bourgeois. What the revolution had proven was that the model of hierarchy that the right had always endorsed, the notion of God in ordained rule, was no longer viable in the Enlightenment era, in an era of increasing secularism. But something had to replace it. And since there was no way that the still non-existent working class could claim power, the bourgeois were going to have to. They were the progressive class at the time. Then their hierarchical rule, their authority in society, had to have a justification, and it was meritocracy. The original Napoleon is a fulfillment of this tension that couldn't be resolved elsewhere. Right, there was no third force that could resolve the tension, because the working class of Paris was tiny and exhausted. The peasantry was still inert, so there was going to be some sort of rapprochement between the sides, and Napoleon was basically the most perfect embodiment of that, because he was the most meritocratic man in the history of France, right? Like, he was, like, the most smart, he was the genius of his era, like, and he'd proven that, and he went on to prove it more and more. Mm-hmm. If anybody was going to be in charge of a syncretic state that had a monarchical a hierarchy, but justified by works rather than relationship to God, it was Napoleon.
And that's what I think is so such a funny thing about this, the concept in Marx, is that it kind of gets at what you're talking about here, but it's so much narrower. You know, the closer you look at the actual events of Brumaire and their aftermath, kind of the less Marxist conception of it makes sense. But the Marxist theory does have some, you know, it does track with real life, just not so much in the specific historical event that he chose to tie it to.
Because the French Revolution, as he was very aware of, cast this pall over, you know, the entire 19th century, and everything. Everybody who was working in a revolutionary capacity was doing it in reference to this previous event, regardless of the specifics of it. And it took a long time for people to get out of that mindset.
I always think it's an interesting phenomenon, the way people just, you know, it's always about, everything is about kind of the last precedent. You know, you go through French Revolutionary history, you find people talking all the time about the English Civil War, which, you know, we call it a civil war, but, I mean, it was a class of people rising up and overthrowing the monarchy. That's really more of a revolution.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the people in France were aware of that, and that's what they looked to as their model.
Right. And then people looked at the French Revolution as a model until the Russian Revolution happened. And then people took that as a model, which many do to this same day.
And what's so fascinating about this stuff is, you know, we can get very arcane. We're talking about these grand theories. But, you know, Marx isn't just a philosopher, because in the 20th century, people tried to put those theories into practice. And that really, you know, scientific socialism was what the Soviets and their allies believed in. They really did believe that this stuff, you know, it was like, I mean, I think it was Engels who compared it to the theory of evolution. You know, they believed this stuff was concrete, and that you could apply it kind of more or less directly to real life.
And that was really more Engels' legacy than Marx's, personally. Engels was the guy who really went the extra mile in trying to codify socialism as a scientific process. Marx was a little more circumspect on that point.
Hmm. But, you know, I love, you know, Soviet history is a big interest of mine, and it's always fascinating to me, you know, a really seminal moment in Stalin's regime was related to this, because Stalin, like most of the rest of the Bolsheviks, you know, was trying to put this stuff into practice. He believed that Bonapartism, in the Marxist sense of the word, was a real threat. Not only that, he had a guy in mind. There was a guy in who was a Red Army general named Mikhail Tukhachevsky, who Stalin called Napoleonchik, which means little Napoleon in Russian.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a layer of, because they had a personal rivalry as well. So you could always have, you know, as anything with Stalin, you always have to wonder how much is personal paranoia and animus versus how much is, you know, realpolitik or theory. But that was the framework Stalin used when he took out Tukhachevsky. And Tukhachevsky was arrested in 1937 and got a bullet. And that was one of the not so much high points, I should probably say low points of the Great Purges, which brought the purges into the army with devastating effect in World War II, obviously. But, you know, I think it's always important talking about these theories that, you know, this isn't just an intellectual exercise. People really did this stuff in real life, informed by these ideas.
Yeah, and in the specific case of the Soviets, it's certainly understandable because the Civil War was this horrifying machine of death, obviously. But one of the unspoken side effects of it, or under-addressed side effects of it, is that it took the working class, with that coherent, powerful working class, which had won the revolution in the cities in Moscow and St. Petersburg in October of 1917, and basically destroyed it. The workers of the cities entered the Red Army and either died or ended up being absorbed into the military itself. And that was always supposed to be the prophylactic against the sort of military takeover. The threat of Bonapartism in the theory of the Bolsheviks was that, well, we have the party, and the party is immune essentially by its structure and by its grounding in the working class to the takeover of an individual personality. But by the end of the Civil War, that working class had been largely shattered, and they were trying frantically to reconstitute it with fresh. The peasants coming in from the countryside and stuff, but the most as a result, as is usually the case when you have a war like that, the institution that has the only institution that comes out of it not destroyed but in fact made stronger is the military, and he was the shining star of that military, and as a result. I mean, I would say I don't honestly know if I believe that Stalin ever really thought that Tukhachevsky was a real threat to do that, to pull a coup. I know that there was an accusation that he was conspiring with the Germans. There's also another argument that the Germans actually planted documents in order to get Stalin to arrest Tukhachevsky, to eliminate the best general that they had. But Stalin was paranoid enough that and jealous enough of power to not need that justification. But it certainly is true that the Red Army was the only threat to the party at that point. But the fact that they were able so easily to arrest and neutralize Tukhachevsky shows that even after the deprivations of the war, that the institutional buildup of the party made the system relatively immune to straight military takeover. And that's one of the reasons that Bonapartism specifically as a concept is over time became less, I would say, relevant, because the original Napoleonic coup was possible due to the relative lack of institutional legitimacy and complexity of that era of in France. You know, like not the government obviously had very little legitimacy, but as a result of that, it had very little meat on its bones, you know. These were still very nascent political institutions. And as a result, they couldn't really stand up to any force as strong as the military, which was the only thing in France that was becoming stronger over the years and more legitimate in people's eyes, importantly. But over time, institutions, you know, as part of the process that the French Revolution helped kick off of states becoming more centralized, authority becoming more invested in durable political and state institutions, those institutions make it harder for one figure to come in on horseback.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, as I was preparing this interview, I was reminded of there's a movie I saw once, a Russian movie, where a Russian character and a French character are talking about their country's histories. The French character mentions the directory, and the Russian character says, "Ah, the directory. Well, we had the directory for 70 years," meaning the Soviet system. And I was thinking about that comment because I don't think that quite tracks. And I think what you were just talking about is kind of gets to the core of why that doesn't quite track, which is that the Soviet, the party and the party ruling apparatus was so much stronger than the Directory.
Yeah.
And more durable and had deeper roots in the society. And basically that's just because, you know, like you said, time had passed and people had, you know, central authorities had gotten better at asserting their control over people and places.
Absolutely.
So I think it's a good point to just kind of branch out and talk more generally about French politics of this era. When you look at France, I mean, you've listened to the show, you've read on your own about this stuff. When you look at France of this era, kind of what strikes you about the political climate?
I mean, just the cynicism, really. Just the exhausted cynicism of people who had seen for a moment what looked like the dawn of a new era of human relations that had failed to come to fruition. And that cynicism, you know, it would track regardless of your beliefs. It was certainly, it applied to people who were horrified by the excesses of the terror. It certainly, and it applied to people who thought that the terror was justified, because either way you saw a just guttering out of idealism in the face either of the totalitarianism of the Committee of Public Safety or in the cynical opportunism of the Directory that followed. And the systematic breakdown of the networks that had allowed for the street power to briefly exist. Like that was the real fundamental fact of the early revolutionary era, was that on a moment's notice, huge crowds could come into the administrative capital of France and dictate terms. And over time, it wasn't just an exhaustion and it wasn't just the war. There was an effort by the Jacobins themselves and those that came after to systematically reduce and annihilate the system of committees and local authorities that could draw those people out. It was gutted from within and from without. And no matter where you were on the spectrum of politics, you saw a revolution that was essentially a zombie. And that, I think, more than anything, explains how Napoleon was able to take power relatively easily, considering how badly he performed on the day itself.
Yeah. Yeah, boy, that's, you know, it's obviously I've seen this story a million times, but going over it, preparing for those episodes, like the deeper you get in, just the more kind of pathetic, really, Napoleon's performance seems. It's really remarkable that he was able to pull that off.
Yeah, thank God for Lucien.
Right. That, I think, takes us naturally into the meat of what I wanted to talk to you about today, which is historians love this question of, when did the French Revolution end? And a lot of people say 18 Brumaire, and, you know, there's good reasons to say so, but it's a pretty hotly debated question, so I wanted to see where you come down on that.
I've been thinking about this because I knew you were going to ask me about it, but I don't want to feel like I'm sort of skipping or like evading it, but I really feel like it depends on whether you want to talk about inside France or outside France. Because I'd say that if you're talking about within France itself, like the forward progress of revolutionary movement, you know, towards a new system, I would honestly say that Thermidor is as good a place as any to end it. Because the people who carried out Thermidor were, and this is often the case when you have a revolution that starts eating itself, the survivors are the most cynical, least idealistic people left, because the people who had convictions ended up saying something that got them killed. And so as soon as the guillotine comes down on Robespierre's neck, for whatever you think of him, that energy is diffused, because, as I was saying, the power of the mob had already sort of been broken by the purge of the Hebertists, and all that was left was for the Directory to play their awful cynical game of whack-a-mole from one side of the spectrum to the other. But I would say, but then I think about internationally, and, you know, the reason the French Revolution is the most studied thing in history, basically, is because of its international repercussions, right? The way that it sparked, you can't understand anything else that happens in the modern era without the French Revolution. I mean, we don't have nationalism, which was the defining movement of 19th century Europe, without the French Revolution. with that in mind, I honestly think it's Waterloo. Because Napoleon's army, wherever it marched, it destroyed feudal systems. It tore up the decaying vestiges of the old order. I mean, it still amazes me. I mean, this is not that the rules of the Doges of Venice, of the Knights of St. John in Malta, and the emperors of the Holy Roman Empire, institutions that had existed for centuries, and in one case a millennia, were all destroyed by one dude. And I think about guys like the Hunt Circle in England, you know, like that circle of young literary critics who were absolutely disgusted by the nastiness and exploitation and stultifying culture of Regency England, that they were all rooting for Napoleon all the time. It reminds me of us whenever we on Chapo talk about how we want a President Xi to show up and liberate us from this nightmare. So, like, as long as Napoleon was in power, regardless of the fact that he was trying to re-entrench a imperial system with his family as the ruling class of Europe, the way that his army, wherever it went, fundamentally altered centuries-old systems, did things like end serfdom where it existed, did things like emancipate Jews wherever it came, impose the Napoleonic Code and a standardized legal system. I feel like that can't be ignored, no matter how much Napoleon ended up being a figure who arrested the revolutionary process in France itself to the degree that it still existed.
Mm. Well, it's interesting because I put some thought into this as well. And I should say we did not compare notes about this beforehand, but we came to very similar conclusions because my thinking is basically you can look at the end of this question of the end of the revolution three ways. The first, if you think of the revolution as kind of a mass-based process to radically change society, I think no question that that's over with the death of Robespierre. No subsequent French government was trying to, you know, completely transform the way people lived their lives and the way the country was governed. You know, the Directory, Napoleon were much more interested in entrenching things that had come about in that early period of the revolution than they were in actually, you know, further social change. If you look at the revolution in terms of kind of a political upheaval and the question of who rules being an open question, well, that probably did end with Brumaire because, mm-hmm. You know, under the Directory, you know, yet we call that whole period the Directory, but there's all these coups and sort of quasi-coups going on that it's still too unsettled, I would say, to call that a new status quo. And that doesn't really come into being until Napoleon's been in charge for a little while. Then the third way to look at it would be kind of the most macro level, you know, how it affected the rest of the world, kind of what were the ideological, what were the values of the regime? And that, I think, you can't say that period you can't really say is over until Waterloo, just because, you know, as long as there's you know, blue jacketed armies out there in the field who are, you know, freeing serfs and imposing Enlightenment principles, that's a little too revolutionary to say, you know, that's just part of the way things had been before.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, of course, if you want to get really contrarian, I think the ultimate kind of provocative, annoying, pedantic answer is the French Revolution never ended, and because we're still living with it.
Too soon to tell.
Right, right. I mean, I think with so much, it's funny because I've had two different guests bring up that Hegel quote, the famous, you know, history on horseback.
History
quote.
On horseback, yes.
And I think, you know, you really get down to it, that is just the best. You know, what's it all mean? What's, you know, what's the point of this show other than entertaining people?
Yeah.
I think that is really what it comes down to, history on horseback.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you want to see how one individual works within a system and within the flow of history and the tide of social and technological and spiritual and economic change, that's what you look at.
And, you know, it's a hard thing to square with. And I've actually seen Marxist historians kind of openly grapple with this, you know, because the Marxist conception of history is, you know, to use one of his favorite buzzwords, it's materialist. It's all about kind of forces, particularly economic forces. And it can be hard to square with this era because, you know, that great man era of historiography is sort of over. But, I mean, we're talking about an era in which one man did have a tremendous influence.
Yeah, I mean, there's another Marx quote, though, that I think is also relevant here. Men make their own history, but they don't make it on their own terms, you know? Because I think that the mechanical view that gets ascribed to Marx and that some Marxists even embrace, I don't think that is, that's not, it's too brittle really to use to really confront history. And I think that it's a good heuristic and it's an important thing because especially talking about a guy like Napoleon, it's incredibly easy to get carried away in a personality just because of how incredibly powerful that personality is. And I think your show is doing a great job of this. You are at every level grounding all of the things that made Napoleon this sui generis figure almost in world history in the context that made that possible. And that he couldn't have been who he was in any other time. That's the important thing. Like his revolutionary military mind, his use of speed, as you talked about early on when you talked about the way that 18th century militaries worked. That was only possible because he was in charge of an army that had basically never existed at a grand scale in Europe before, which was a motivated citizen soldiery who could police themselves and did not need to be, you know, whipped by a quartermaster to keep them from running away every time they went to take a leak. And that gave him this XP boost that no other army could compare with. And that was not his doing, but his genius was recognizing. Mm-hmm. But at every level, there's an interaction here between the personality and the conditions that they're working with.
Now that we're moving into dangerous ground here, but when you try to imagine this era and then, you know, the later 19th century without Napoleon, what does that look like?
Wow. I mean, I have a hard time seeing the directory end any other way than some sort of coup d'etat. Just because of its instability, because of the crying out for some sort of figure to resolve the conflict. But I think we can say safely, whoever that figure would have been, whether they would have been some sort of successful restoration effort by, you know, maybe with the help of the British or a different general, it would have been much less successful for France, just as a, you know, the French nation is a project, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can see a restoration of a weak sort of client king, you know, like sort of a British vassal king, which would have made France, would have broken France's power almost overnight and led it to like lose its status as the premier power in Europe. I could see another general taking power. The question of Napoleon and how much he fought all the time. And obviously he was good at it. And at a certain level, he enjoyed it. He must have. But at another level is that as long as that state existed, as long as the regicide state of France existed, the powers of Europe were going to have a very vested interest in seeing it destroyed. And I don't know if any other military man who might have taken Napoleon's place would have been able to withstand that. So I'd say either way, France does not become the driving force of European social order in the 19th century. I don't know who fills the gap. Maybe the British. I don't know.
Yeah, see, that to me is the hard question, is who fills the gap. Because without Napoleon, I'm not sure you get German or Italian unification.
Absolutely.
Certainly not as quickly or as
no
forcefully.
Way. Yeah.
So I guess that means the British would step in, but...
But they were such a bunch of contented shopkeepers at that point, you know?
Right. And I think that, you know, they've never really excelled at projecting land power on the continent.
On the continent, no.
And so I just... That to me is a very interesting question. And I wanted to get your thoughts on it because a listener asked me that, and I kind of dodged the question because it is so hard to imagine.
I don't know. I mean, all I can think is, I just think that the processes that ended up shaping Europe, I think they still happen. because none of this is determined by these relatively happenstance items of what general takes over in which country. Mm-hmm. But they, I think the most you can say is they probably happen much more slowly.
Right.
You know, the process of nationalism, of centralization, the breakup of the old order, probably the Industrial Revolution, because it's hard to overstate the effect of the war economy in England in spurring that. It probably all happens, but on a longer timetable.
Yeah, I mean, the question of industrialization, the population of free peasants in Germany is what really drove, like, for instance, the Rhineland industrial boom. And I don't think there would be a population of free peasants in the Rhineland if not for Napoleon.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's just, you know, again, it's hard to see, you know, the world taking a totally different course, you know, just because those forces dragging us into the future are so powerful. But I mean, God, there would have been a lot to, you know, arrest that speed at which they developed in the 19th century.
Yeah.
So, any other stray thoughts? Anything you wanted to talk about?
I think I got out everything I wanted to say. Yeah, I had some points and I think I made them.
Yeah, well, I was shooting for half an hour. That's about where we're at. So
perfect.
That was Matt Chrisman. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. If you want to hear more from Matt, you can find his writing in The Outline, Jacobin Magazine, and Current Affairs. Or, of course, you could listen to his satirical left-wing political podcast, Chapo Trap House. Thanks for listening.